Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We expect hurricanes out in the Atlantic hitting places like Bermuda, Miami, Florida, Charleston, South Carolina, maybe in the Gulf of Mexico, slamming into Tampa, Biloxi, New Orleans, or Houston, or roaring through the Caribbean over Haiti or Puerto Rico. Dumping down on a northern clime like Vermont seems completely out of the ordinary, but don't tell that to Mother Nature, especially when the ocean waters are warming up. As we sit one day from the 10-year anniversary of Tropical Storm Irene and a few days past a not-so-angry Henri, at least in Vermont, it's time to talk hurricanes and get a better understanding of them and what our future might bring. Here to help us with all of that is Radio Vermont forecaster Roger Hill. Roger, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be back.
Great to have you. Listeners, to ask Roger anything you'd like to know about hurricanes or to share any that you've experienced firsthand, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Roger, we'll get to some of these others, and we just heard in the news Ida, but let's start with the basis of hurricanes. What causes a hurricane to start in the first place?
Well, these are disturbances that form in basically, in our case, the Atlantic Ocean, but of course they're worldwide. They're called different names, typhoons out in the Pacific, for example. I think off of Australia, they used to call them Willy Willies, some crazy names, but they're all the same beast. They're a warm core center of low pressure that feeds off latent heat off the warm sea surface temperatures of the ocean. Typically, you have to have about 78, 79 degrees or higher to get this to happen, and it's this interaction of the latent heat of the ocean with this tropical cyclone to build and intensify. What can ruin a tropical cyclone, and we hear about this from time to time with certain conditions such as La Nina and El Nino. El Nino has a tendency to produce a stronger kind of what we call a subtropical jet stream, and that jet stream, those higher winds aloft at jet stream level, have a tendency to knock them back and not really allow them to develop. They need to be more or less kind of a center of outflow, and if the outflow is bent in one particular way or slanted, if you will, in the atmosphere, they don't really develop into a strong tropical cyclone. So they start out as what we call a tropical depression, really an easterly wave, and they originate as far back to the really to the east of us as the Sahel of Africa, and then going back over toward even the Sudan. So that particular area, these waves of low pressure track westward. Oftentimes they produce even Saharan dust storms on their northern sort of flank, and some of that dust actually is another sort of downfall to tropical cyclone development. I'll get into that a little bit later. But needless to say, these come off of West Africa, and they're known, the stronger ones are known as the Cape Verde storms, and these happen during the peak season, basically July, August, September. But sort of on the outer fringes of the season, say May, June, they have a tendency to form in the warmer waters. And again, you need temperatures above approximately about 78, 79, 80 degrees sea surface temperatures for this to happen. But that happens, of course, in the Caribbean Basin where it's warm all the time. Same thing in the Gulf of Mexico. So some of our early season storms will come out of this sort of Caribbean Basin region, and especially the Gulf of Mexico, and then track, sometimes be picked up by the jet stream and then worked up the coast. Later in the season, that's the same kind of thing, but there's a couple of things we refer to in meteorology called the main development region, and that's basically from West Africa right through into the Caribbean Basin, and these are the areas just into the subtropics, a little north of the equator, where the main development region is, and this is where our most warmest water is. But due to climate change and the ocean's warming, which takes about 96% of the energy from fossil fuels and carbon dioxide, dancing those molecules and heating up the atmosphere as we know it, well, more of that energy goes into the oceans. And so it's kind of a slow simmer, a slow boil, if you will, but it's raising those sea surface temperatures and making conditions a little bit better for those to form. Now, if we don't have the shear that I just described, which occurred during La Nina years, and, of course, that's another ocean reference, and that's the sea surface temperatures in the subtropics and the Pacific Ocean, that has a lot to do with the Atlantic Ocean. And so when we have colder than normal waters, we don't have that shear, that subtropical jet stream, to sort of knock them back. When things are wide open, such as right now, such as last year, we have, you know, a strings of named storms that become tropical depressions, tropical storms, strength, and then they reach 74 mile per hour sustained winds, and that's a hurricane, of course, and they go from Cat 1 to Cat 5, or Category 5. Right. And lately, we've been seeing a lot of this sort of spin up faster, and part and parcel, this is due to that latent heat from those very, very warm oceans.
So, Roger, when this storm develops, becomes a tropical depression, tropical storm, it's out over a great body of water like the Atlantic Ocean, maybe the Gulf of Mexico. Is it sucking up a lot of that moisture, a lot of that liquid into the hurricane? And how is that done?
Well, it's the it has a lot to do with thermodynamics, and it's kind of hard to explain it, but the latent heat that comes off the ocean is the water, of course, is warm, and if it's cool aloft, that causes an upward vertical motion or convection. And so you get thunderstorms that basically build, and the thunderstorms sort of build in their outflow, that is, in the upper levels of the storms. They have that typical anvil you think of. Well, that outflow symmetrically has to be taking place as well. So if you get a good out-venting, if you will, of thunderstorms, it allows them to form, and then begin the Coriolis effect causes that to spin. And so hence you get a counterclockwise flow in the northern hemisphere, and southern hemisphere is the opposite, a clockwise flow. And these produce, of course, they spin up into a tropical cyclone, a tropical depression, tropical storm, category 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hurricane.
And the categories, just to be clear, are calculated by the wind speeds. Is that right? Like once it hits 74, it's a Cat 1 and then goes up as the speeds go up?
That is correct. And that is not counting gusts or anything like that. So the climatology of tropical cyclones and hurricanes is typically they come off of, during the peak season, if you will, they come off this African, West African coast and then continue south of the Cape Verde Islands and then spin up, intensify if there's no interference with shear. And they're typically at some point in their life cycle, these long-winded type storms will encounter that. We think of an Irene was one of those. Gloria, Floyd, some of the storms that affected Vermont, moving up the eastern seaboard, say Hurricane Bob and so forth, the 1938 hurricane. These were all, I don't know about the 38, but I believe so. These are probably more than likely well-developed systems peaking in September. And typically the 10th of September is the absolute peak day. And then there's a little bit of a secondary peak, and I'll get into that in a second. But that is all basically a contribution of the latent heat, the lack of wind shear aloft, and open territory over a big body of water. And, of course, the Atlantic Ocean's a pretty good distance there of several thousand miles.
Let's talk about the course they take. And I wonder why they wobble in a crazy-legged course like me after four heady toppers. What causes that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they do. if you look at just how we have satellites, of course, and great technology that follow them, but satellites can zap onto them, and of course we follow them, and you can see they go through these different cycles. They form eye walls, is what we call, and the eye wall is right around the eye center, if you will, And that's where, of course, the strongest winds are, and that's where the tallest thunderstorms are. That's when the main action is. That's where the maximum upward vertical motion is. So they undergo these eyewall sort of changes, and there's kind of a life cycle of a hurricane inside. And the eyewall changes, sometimes you can have a really strong hurricane and have no eye, but it's undergoing kind of a different aspect to it. And I can't really get into exactly why that is, but I can tell you that they do this quite frequently, and it leads to these sort of little wobbles and whatnot. Also, they ingest drier air, you know, on one side of the storm, and then it basically pinwheels. It's kind of like if you look at maybe a lollipop, you know, with the swirls of different flavors.
Oh, right.
Well, it's the same kind of thing. You have drier air, and it swirls in toward the center, and that causes a little bit of a change in course. And, of course, nowadays we have a lot of reconnaissance aircraft flying into that. And each time that data, those recons from those, they have what we call dropsons. They're dropping instrumentation into the storm itself, into the eyewall, into the eye, and in the outer areas of the they're looking for, you know, basically no shear. And all these metrics and measurements go into forecasting or projecting through the computer modeling a real nice narrow track. Now, looking back, if you think about Irene was really spectacular in one way, not only that it made it all the way to Vermont and did all the damage it did, but Irene had an incredibly tight track based off the computer modeling world because we had a lot of recons, the good reconnaissance. There was not a lot of shear to knock it back, and so forth. And so the projected tracks were real, real narrow. And so we knew where it was going to go, right up the eastern seaboard, right along the coastal areas. And with its forward inertia, of course, it made it all the way into Vermont. And it was basically modeled to do that.
Well, I am really impressed by how they are able to make those predictions on where the hurricanes will be going and tracking them. And they're usually pretty accurate until they're not, but I think they do a great job. Let's go to the phones. Start with Fred in Newbury. Hi, Fred.
Morning.
Morning.
Hey, I'm wondering if we had a – I don't know exactly what the volumes would be or the percentages, but I'd just say if we had – say 75% of the glaciers were to melt, and that melting period would take, say, less than 5 years, that would disrupt the Atlantic conveyor enough to change the climate significantly, and that could probably be the precursor to an ice age. What say you?
That's interesting because you would have certainly ice melting, you know, in theory, maybe increasing the temperature of the waters, Roger. You know, how does going from melting ice take us to an ice age? Is that possible, Roger?
Well, there is actually there's this sort of oscillation that's been taking place with a little ice age that occurred back in the northern part of the Atlantic Ocean. It's more regional. The entire world, that's kind of a broader subject or topic to try to get into. But
sure.
How it might relate to tropical storms, of course, is when you have, first of all this energy going into the ocean, and that's raising the temperature of the ocean, it also causes the ocean to expand. And that expansion is also raising the sea levels, if you will. Now, mm-hmm. Here comes a hurricane. Let's say 10, 15 years ago, same hurricane went through, maybe caused damage, maybe didn't quite cause damage. Well, now there's a better chance for that. Why? Because we have higher sea levels. They're not huge in the amount of, say, 10 or 15 years, but they're increasing more as we're getting that ice melt. That's one way that basically applies. The other way is that we're seeing, you know, on top of the rising sea levels, we're seeing, and this includes the eastern seaboard, which is rising much faster, we're seeing a slowdown in the Gulf Stream. The slowdown in the Gulf Stream is causing more heat, more heated water, instead of curving more out toward Europe and, say, toward Iceland in the Atlantic. It's slowing down, and it's causing these sort of meanders, much like we talk about when the jet stream is due to loss of sea ice, is causing these meandering jet streams, and occasionally crazy things happen. Hmm. And I can get to that with Henri, because that was one part and parcel connection to climate change as an attribute. But needless to say, the warmer water, the latent heat, and the fact that the Gulf Stream is slowing is causing more of that warmer water to head up the eastern seaboard. When you have more latent heat to work off, the same tropical cyclone that might have been 100 years ago would run into much colder waters off of New England where the temperatures are much colder. Well, nowadays, because of the slowing Gulf Stream, the warming of the ocean plus the slowing Gulf Stream is basically a lot of that warmer water now is going right up against New England. And if you look at the sea surface temperature anomalies, we are several degrees Fahrenheit above normal. And what does that do? Well, let's say Tropical Storm Irene. Now, it was similar to that with Irene, but it's even warmer now. And the fact that Irene did go from a Category 1 hurricane, it was originally a Category 2, and it went to lost a little steam as it went inland, as they usually do. They interact with the land, and they don't quite get their intensities back. But right. It dumped off the coast and around New Jersey, and now with that warmer water, it's going to allow those hurricanes to remain stronger. They're not going to turn extra tropical. They're not going to make that transition more or less into what we think of as, I say, a nor'easter, a regular temperate type storm. So it allows that with global warming and climate change and the fact that there's a lot of fresh water coming in off of the glaciers, it's rearranging and slowing the conveyor belts of the ocean. And that is also helping to slow down that Gulf Stream, which in turn then raises the water temperatures, which allows for more latent heat and so on and so forth, and i.e. makes for stronger tropical cyclones working, into New England.
Oh, boy. Let's take another call. Forbes is joining us. Hi, Forbes. Good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. How are you?
Great.
This is I'm kind of taking it off course of your hurricanes, but
all right.
And probably time for another time to discuss. But the Farmer's Almanac, I was always interested in how that was ever formulated and what's the degree of efficiency.
All right, Forbes, thanks for that question. Roger, I'm sure you've looked at the Farmer's Almanac in your years of forecasting and, you know, kind of looked to see if it was accurate at all. But how did they or do they forecast a year out, and how accurate are they?
You know, here's the thing. You could take a dart. We know that it's cold in the winter and it's hot in the summer. Now, right. If you throw so many darts and it lands in, yes, it's cold in the winter, it's hot in the summer, you can say that you hit your forecast. They use several different things as I know it, but I can't really get into what all of their, all of their tools that they might use.
Sure.
But first of all, we have what we call climatology. We know that it gets warm in the summer and it's cold in the winter. So that's a given. Now, does it snow? Yes, it does. How many percentage days of the time did it snow in Vermont on, I don't know, pick a day, December 15th? More often probably than not, there was some kind of snow. So you see what I'm saying? You can use climatology, and part of that is what they use. And then they use some moon cycles. They look at, of course, the main flippers are, there's quite a few of them, and it's all about the oceans. It's conveyor belts and whatnot. La Nina, El Nino, they probably use certain sunspot cycles. When there's a little bit more sunspot cycle, more sunspots, we're going into slight, it's minutia, but it's a little extra heating from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be another measurement. There's a lot of different metrics like that, but I can't answer the specifics on how they make their forecast. I would say most of the time they're going to get it right because they're sticking to more or less climatology.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just stick to climatology, your skill level is maybe 51% or something.
Take some old data and, use the science, and you should be able to at least be about 75% accurate with a little bit of guesswork. So
a little bit of guesswork. But, oftentimes they're not accurate, and people say, they're always accurate. Well, if you really look at what they're saying over a course of this particular week versus next week, you're going to find their accuracy slips a little bit.
All right. We got a couple minutes before the break. So let's talk about Ida that's barreling through the Gulf of Mexico heading to New Orleans. What do we know about that, Roger?
Well, right now there's a reconnaissance hurricane aircraft hunter in there, and right now it's dropping drop sons, and so they're going to get a narrower, tighter track on it, and the track already is pretty tight by all the various models. When you think about it, these computer models are pretty amazing because they're using different differential equations to arrive on a forecast projection. And if you have, you know, model A, model B, model C, model D, F, and they're all coming out with basically a fairly very tight, narrow forecast track. And by the way, the forecast track is a lot better these days. The forecast intensities remains to be a little harder to do. But that forecast track is pretty tight right now, and I have to say it's a big-time problems. It could be a Category 3 coming very, very close, a little bit to the left or west of the mouth of the Mississippi. And if that were to continue that track, it wouldn't be too far from New Orleans. And, of course, we know what problems become from New Orleans with strong winds, heavy rain, storm surge, and whatnot.
What was Katrina when it hit New Orleans, Roger?
It went up to a Cat 5, but I believe it had come down to about a Cat 3 at that point.
All right. Roger Hill's taking us deep into the meteorology playbook, helping us to understand hurricanes. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update from them, and maybe get an update on Ida. And then we'll come back for some more intense weather classroom instruction with Roger Hill. And tonight on WDEV, the Red Sox hit the road. They head to Cleveland, and they're going to play the soon-to-be Guardians. Our coverage begins at 6:10 with the game getting underway at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We've got the rain slickers and the welly boots on as we stand out in the approaching storm to report on the next hurricane headed our way. Hopefully that won't be for a while, but the hurricane season is just really starting to feel its oats. Radio Vermont forecaster Roger Hill spending the hour with us, helping us to understand hurricanes, answering your questions about them. To speak with Roger, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Roger, you mentioned peak season and September 10th a little earlier, so we're really not up to speed yet, are we, on hurricane season?
No, I mean, you know, we've seen a flurry. We got there's three or four different tropical cyclones that are brewing right now besides Ida. And so, and why is that? Well, roughly about the 10th of September, it's the maximum amount of summer heating that is accumulated as energy for tropical storms, tropical cyclones, hurricanes to work with. And so the Atlantic Hurricane Basin and the main development region especially is at its maximum peak heating roughly about the 10th of September. And it's very much aligned and related to that. The lack of shear, of course, helps that, as I talked about. And this time of year is when things are very active, and indeed there's a whole flurry of different tropical easterly waves coming off of Africa right now, and there's quite a few. The things that I've noticed, too, is the other thing is they're not just always coming off of Africa. Sometimes they develop, as I talked about, in the Gulf of Mexico or the Caribbean Basin in the early and toward the end of the seasons. But also lately, the other thing they're doing, I laugh because I haven't seen this before, and with climate change warming the water up the way it is, they're starting to develop off of Bermuda. That's where Henri came from. Henri kind of developed, and this is out of the main development region, an oddball, if you will.
Yeah.
It developed east of Bermuda, or even northeast, I believe, kind of went southwest around Bermuda, and then made its slow right turn in and up the eastern seaboard. The other thing about Tropical Storm Henri that I also want to mention, and this goes back to that other hurricane that is pretty big on the East Coast most recently, and that's Sandy. What did Sandy do and what did Henri do? They both made a left turn. Don't really see that very often. Lately, we're starting to see that a little bit more, well, based on another one that just took place, Henri. And the reason for that, squirrely jet streams. And sometimes during this time of year, typically in midsummer, we would find a jet stream way up in sort of the middle part of Canada, way to the north of us. Well, now we're getting these sort of weird wavy oscillations. So what does that do? It develops a trough of lower pressure. That lower pressure then pulled Henri into it, much like same thing that happened, only even on a bigger scale. It pulled Sandy into the coast of New Jersey, and we know what Sandy did.
Yeah, and getting started out at Bermuda, people realize that Bermuda is pretty far north. It's kind of directly across from North Carolina, so it's not sitting down in the Caribbean. It's not sitting down off the coast of Africa. Let's take another call. Marcia joining us from Barrie. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, morning, Rick, and morning, Roger. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions, and I'll give you both the questions, and then I'll please listen off the air.
Okay.
The first one is when you give the when you give the average temperatures to compare our daily ones, are you using the new average ones that just came out in because of global warming? And the second question is, with hydrogen becoming a more used fuel in cars, and the exhaust from these cars is water, if more and more cars use this fuel, will this increase the humidity in the air, and would that affect the weather and the climate?
All right. Thanks for those questions. Roger, first
one. I'm
going
to discuss the last one first, okay, and we'll get back to the average temperatures.
Okay.
So it's probably true, yes, it would contribute, but it's probably on a very, very, very small scale of minutia. But it is more with hydrogen a hydrogen fuel cell and how it works or whatever. I think it would be most problematic if folks are driving up and down a particular highway and adding that little extra moisture. We might have a little ice that might develop due to that. And I just kind of thought of that, you know, out of the blue one day, and it's like, how would that be dealt with? So I don't have a lot of answers. I think it's, it's based off a lot of mathematical metrics. If X had such amount of, you know, cars that were driving hydrogen fuel cells, what would the answer be to that, and how that would affect the roads and whatnot? It could be problematic. It could be. It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the average temperatures. Yes, we come out in climatology. There's these 30-year average temperatures. They have a baseline of. So right now we're basing everything off of what happened approximately 30 years ago, up through the last 30 years, up through 2010. And we're using that set of statistics to base everything off of. And, of course, before that point, the temperatures were cooler, so that baseline was much more and so forth. So if you keep going back in these incremental periods of climatology that we're using the baselines for, it's really a little bit of a moving target, and it all illustrates the fact that the planet's warming, and it's warming pretty rapidly, and we're now basing everything off of more recent climatology, and we're comparing those notes, and those notes show that the temperatures are much warmer. The thing that worries me the most right now is what's going on with the conveyor belt the Gulf Stream, the AMOC, Atlantic Meridional, I can barely say the word, Meridional overturning circulation, which has conveyor belts all throughout the ocean, everywhere, underneath and whatnot, and that's what kind of drives it. And the fact that we're losing the freshwater dump off Greenland due to climate change, due to warm temperatures over Greenland. By the way, they just had a massive heat wave, and it unloaded tremendous tonnage of fresh water into the Atlantic Ocean, and that is messing with these conveyor belts, and that slowing of the conveyor belt is now increasing the warmth along the East Coast. What does that mean for hurricanes that make a run-up? For example, the 1938 hurricane was what really hit us hard here in Vermont and in parts of New England, of course. It had a very fast forward speed, and it's that forward inertia for example, Irene had a pretty fast forward speed, but it, not like the 1938 Hurricane. What made the 38 Hurricane stand out so much was the fact that it was off Cape Hatteras about, I think, 24 hours prior. And at that point in time, we didn't have the technology we have, but it moved north very quickly. And when you have, it didn't have time to turn extratropical. It didn't, as it ran into the colder waters north of the headwall of the Gulf Stream, hurricanes should fall apart and they should become tropical storms. Well, the 38 Hurricane was just cooking right along, and it had such forward inertia that it just went right into Vermont. And now with these warmer sea surface temperatures, what if we have a fast-moving hurricane with a lot of inertia come off the coast? I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah. And, Roger, you know, I think of Vermont as so far away from hurricane world down there in the Caribbean, the Gulf. But once it slides up the coast, like you're talking about, I mean, we're not that far. We're like a three wood away from the ocean, aren't we?
Right.
I tried to
it's
calculate.
It's really not that far away. The ocean effects are giant. Of course, with the nor'easters, we know that they work off the latent heat also of the ocean. And they power up these very super strong low pressure systems, but it's a different kind of animal. It's the baroclinicity. It's a baroclinicity implying really cold temperatures next to really warm temperatures, and that's where you get plus the Coriolis effect. You'll spin up an area of low pressure in theory, and it's that whole factor that takes place with a nor'easter in the middle of the winter. And of course, it brings us giant snowstorms. It brings the rain snow line and whatnot off to the south and east of our region along the coast. And more often now, it's bringing these rainy systems into southern New England and heavy-duty wet snow into the northern part of New England. And, of course, that's also causing power outages. Yeah. A lot of things going on there with warm water.
Wow. Let's head back to the phones. Duxbury, we go for Nils. Hi, Nils. Go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I just tuned in, so I didn't realize this was specific to hurricanes. So this is a question that Roger might not want to answer, which
okay.
is fine.
We
There's
take them
lots
all.
Of fires right now out west, and I know Vermont used to have fire towers everywhere, and I'm curious what has changed or what's Vermont's history with catastrophic forest fire, and that's the question. I can listen to the answer off the air.
All right, thanks, Nils, for that. Roger, do you have info on that?
If I heard you right, my phone was kind of cutting out a little bit, but it was forest fires. Is that what I heard?
Yeah. So we see them out west, you know, with great abundance. We used to have the fire towers here in Vermont, which, you know, would mean we probably had more back then. But why aren't we seeing the catastrophic forest fires in Vermont? There hasn't been one in a long time.
There was I can't remember exactly the year. I think there's been more than one where we had actually in the north central Vermont areas of like the Groton Forest burnt to the ground. I mean, it was devastating, and I think it went all the way up to almost to the top of the Worcester Range, and it took out a lot of trees. And I can't remember the year that was, but there was we've had these in the past. You know, this is obviously what causes that is lack of rainfall, a very severe drought, maybe a drought that might go on for a couple of years, and it would be terrible to think of, but it is possible that with our variability that's coming in with climate change, it doesn't rule out that possibility that we would have, you know, a two-year drought, three-year drought, maybe very little snow, very low spring melt, mm-hmm. And then a dry summer, and then you add two of those maybe together, and all of a sudden, wow, look at what we have to burn. We have a lot to burn. If you've ever taken birch bark and burnt it, you know the energy that holds to burn, mm-hmm. and it's like some of the stuff that they have out west, the same kind of situation. So it could be very devastating, but how would that interact with tropical cyclones? I don't know. I do know that dust coming in off the Sahara has a tendency to dampen tropical cyclone formation. A part of it is because it's also in conjunction with an area of higher pressure that is causing so much sinking motion. That sinking motion is going to go up against the upward vertical motion, and when the two are interacting there, the sinking motion might win. So that's part of the reason for that. And so dust, I know what it does when it comes off the Sahara due to research It basically dampens the amount of tropical cyclone formation. Once a good hurricane is already up, you know, stepped up and going, and it's very symmetrical, well, it's off to the races then without any kind of shear. As far as forest fire smoke, we're starting to see that more and more for our summers here as the West is burning up. Unfortunate, they have something like one of the second worst droughts they've seen on record, going back with tree ring sources 2,000 years. So it's very significant. The boreal forest is a big-time smoke producer to our north up in Canada. When it goes on fire, and if they have drought up there, that's also another source for big-time smoke. But the dampening effect of that has two things. It also cuts down the temperature. It doesn't get as hot, believe it or not, because you're filtering the sun and you're reflecting that back into outer space, outgoing long-wave radiation. But the other thing is that the smoke, of course, causes respiratory problems and poor air quality. And, of course, we've been witnessing that from time to time and probably will continue to do this now for many summers to come.
All right. And, Nils, I'll try to put together a show on forest fires that might answer some of your questions more fully, and we'll focus on that someday. Next, we go to Henry. Now, let's call him Henri from Charlotte.
Henri.
Yeah. Go ahead, Henry. What do you got?
Henri, yeah. The pronunciation really doesn't have an N in it. It's Henri.
Henri, you got
Henri.
It.
At any rate, I have a question. I was 11 years old when Hurricane Carol came through in 54.
Mm.
And in my memory, that was the most severe hurricane that I remember in my lifetime so far. The lake was brown, brown, and there were dead cattle floating around, and docks and trees, and but I don't recall. Maybe Roger can enlighten me on this. I know there was a heck of a lot of rain and wind, but do you know how bad the wind was? I don't remember.
All right, let's see what Roger can remember going back to 54 Hurricane Carol. Anything?
I can't. I'd have to look up. There's a really good book with a lot of that really good data by David M. Ludlam. I'm sure everyone's heard of him before. He has spectacular books that he's written on Vermont climatology and whatnot. And I know that Carol's part of that. I think Carol might have was more into New York, if I remember correctly. I might be confusing Agnes, but Carol was a little bit to the left of our region, a little bit to the west.
Yeah, I think Agnes was when I was a kid. That would have been maybe in the late 60s, early 70s, because that came through Pennsylvania. It's interesting, as we've been talking about Irene and hurricanes all week, no one's really mentioned Carol from 54, so I might have to do a little research for you, Henry. As we're wrapping up the show, we got about 3 minutes, Roger. Let's go back to 10 years ago today. This would have been the day before Irene hit. And what were we expecting from Irene as she came up the coast?
We were expecting a ton of rain. What ends up happening is these systems that come up about this latitude, they start to undergo extratropical tendencies. And what ends up happening is the dirty side of the storm is the right side of the storm, and that sort of eastern semicircle is where the wind is located. So you get the strongest winds because you're adding not only the circulation of a weakening tropical cyclone as it moves inland, you're adding the forward momentum. So that adds to that. So we didn't get the windy side, but we did get the rainy side. And to the left of the center on its western semicircle is where all the heavy rain is, and probably closest to the actual center itself, of course. But we all know what happened. It was 8 inches of rain in a mountainous terrain, and we know what damage it did that took out bridges that were over 150 years old, et cetera, which explains that, well, they haven't had that kind of condition for 150 years at that particular spot to take that bridge out. So very significant, obviously. But one of the other things that people might overlook, and that is, what is the antecedent condition? That is, what is the soil moisture, for example, like? How rainy have we had conditions leading up to tropical cyclones? That plays a giant role in how the runoff plays. And when we think of hurricanes coming into Vermont, it's really not so much wind, although the 38 hurricane packed a big punch. We're thinking more in terms of the rain falling out of the sky and how much can it take. And, of course, tropical cyclones hold their powerhouses of moisture, and they've pulled all that moisture together, and now they're raining it out of the sky over a very short period of time, and sometimes you can get 2 months of rainfall falling in 12 hours or 6 hours.
And we did come off a very wet spring. We had flooding. We had a lot of snow melt that year. We have about 45 seconds. Was there anything big like an El Nino going on that year that caused so much, moisture in the spring and then Irene later at this time of the year?
It was just a kind of, as I recall, and I'm not looking at anything that history in front of me, but 2011 was a pretty wild scenario for the East Coast, the Northeast United States. We had severe thunderstorms. We had tremendous rains in May that year, the late part of May. It also caused floods that almost equaled the 1927 flood. It flooded in Waterbury, and, of course, the Winooski River Basin was kind of ground zero for that. And then, of course, what happened on August 28th, 2011 followed. And, again, very antecedent, very wet conditions. That wet condition, prior to a hurricane moving up the coast is all too important.
You can find Roger Hill's website at weatheringheights.com, his Weather Classroom podcast at wdevradio.com. Roger, my head is exploding with facts. Thanks so much for the education this morning.
My pleasure.
All right, take care. All right. Well, let's see. We've got top of the hour at CBS News up next. Then we'll be back to hear what's going on around the world, the country, from national correspondent Bob Ney. Coming up today at 1, it's Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Dr. Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Time to check in with our national correspondent, Bob Ney, to get an update on what's happening in the world. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, good morning, Rick.
All right, Bob. Just two topics. We're going to talk COVID. We're going to talk Afghanistan. Let's start with the numbers.
Yes, with the United States, the total deaths are 630,928. Worldwide, 4,457,027 people have passed from COVID. And, of course, the stats, too, that we're looking at is, the hospital rates, which are, obviously increasing. And, again, it does depend on the state. I looked at a state-by-state, which you all lead still, state-by-state percentages of amount of people vaccinated. In Ohio, for example, my home state is 51%. So it's pretty low, and I think that the big push now is to, obviously get more people vaccinated. It's got to be the cause of the day.
Bob, if people need, we can show them how to roll up sleeves. We are very good at that here in Vermont. So now, what's
must be. You've got the best stats in the nation.
Yeah, 85%. J&J, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, probably going to need a booster there.
Right. I think, frankly, and you're going to see boosters in all of them. I stopped yesterday at the Licking County Medical Center just to ask them, and they said soon the boosters will be, they'll be scheduling boosters over there, because I was just curious. And they said it was boosters for any of the previous vaccines that you've had.
Yep. All right. So no matter what you've had, be prepared. You're going to probably need a booster. I think in Vermont, we're going to handle it the same way we did originally and start with the seniors, you know, the most vulnerable, and then work our way down. And it worked very well, very efficiently. This was interesting, Bob, the NRA canceling a big convention of theirs.
Right. That is interesting because they canceled their annual meeting. You know, a lot of groups are going ahead with meetings, you know, and the NRA itself said due to COVID, it's canceling the meeting. And that's because they're expecting the surge in the Delta variant.
Mm-hmm.
And they analyzed COVID-19 data from Houston, Texas, Harris County. And due to that and the rise in Texas, is why. If they had had this maybe in another state, then possibly they may have, you know, continued it. But due to where they had it, they canceled it.
Yeah, and this Delta variant is pretty scary. So I can absolutely understand their trepidation. The Pentagon ordering their troops to get vaccinated.
Yes, they have. The Pentagon has mandated the vaccination. They're ordering them to get vaccinated immediately. And Georgia also is sending National Guard to hospitals during the surge. And then you've got other states where, and I'm mentioning that because you've got other states where they have National Guard. And so they're considering mandating the vaccination to their National Guards.
And we're seeing a lot of, we'll just call them fights over mask mandates. Seems like we've got more important things in life to worry about than whether or not we're being asked to wear a mask or not. But this is really stirring passions.
Well, it is, especially, of course, the most high-profile state is Florida right now. They have the high number of the surges of the COVID cases. And, of course, it's very vocal. The governor in Florida is telling schools that if you do the mask mandate when the state has said you're not going to mandate, then they're going to cut your funds. And, there's struggles in other states, don't get me wrong, but I think Florida is probably the one that's highlighted the most.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to Afghanistan. This is the two, stories that we really need to talk about, COVID and Afghanistan. So far it seems that both sides really, holding their water, just taking their time and trying to get, this to go as smoothly as possible, as something like this can go. But worst possible situation, suicide bombers.
Well, it is, and especially what happened, because the bomber was dressed, well, I'm going to say dressed as a refugee, frankly, a lot of the Afghan, dress is the same, like sort of a tunic,
right,
which, by the way, allows you to hide a lot of things.
Yeah.
And so he came to the gate and then blew himself up, at the point he was near the entry to the gate. And so that was part of the problem. Now they have to decide how much further they take that entry point back, to try to stop this for the remaining days that they have left. So this will change some of the procedure of how they do it. And then also there's the numbers of the Americans, which, by the way, the numbers are wild. They're all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You and I talked last week, I know, about 15,000 Americans. Now the government says 4,500 Americans have left and 1,500 remain. So if you do the math, that's about 6,000 Americans, not 15,000 Americans. And, of course, they're estimating 250,000 Afghans who are supposed to leave are going to be on those lists. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
The Americans have a chance to get through because the Taliban wants us gone. The Afghans, I think, will have way, way less chance to get through the Taliban. And there's ISIS-K, Rick, which I wanted to mention because ISIS-K are enemies of the Taliban. So they themselves could disrupt, ISIS-K could, Americans leaving in order to kind of cross the Taliban over.
Wow.
Very complicated.
Yeah. Bob, I mean, it's hard to watch. And, you know, we saw this in Vietnam as well. Whenever this kind of thing happens, is there any graceful way? Is there any right way of being able to conduct this and get out of a country that does not want you there anymore?
Well, you know, there's several things. I've read stories just for, I just wanted to throw this out here before answering that question, Rick. I've read stories about Afghani nationals who moved to the United States, and they went back to Afghan this summer, and you would say, why on earth are people doing that?
Right.
Americans remaining in Afghanistan. I mean, why would you be doing that? But, you
exactly.
know, people do that. I was in Iran during the revolution. You think that you're not going to be part of things, and the next thing you know, you say, wow, I better get out.
Right.
And so that happened because they thought the national, you know, soldiers of Afghanistan could hold all of this, et cetera, et cetera. I think that what could have been done different, of course, it's Monday morning quarterbacking, but, mm-hmm. Rick, frankly, I imagine a more planned exodus starting back in, you know, March or April
right.
of trying to get, you know, people out methodically on a weekly basis. But again, the intel sources didn't say the country was going to collapse in 12 days.
Right. I've heard that there were efforts by the State Department to try to convince Americans to get out earlier. Have you heard that at all, or do you know if that's?
Oh yes, and from speaking from personal experience, I went to Iran in January of 1978, and the revolution had its beginnings in February of 78, and there were riots and martial law and everything else, and I and 40,000 other Americans were still in the country in around June of 1978. And again, you know, you're over there, the embassy warns you, if you don't have to be here, leave.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just remain because they're doing what they're doing and they think, you know, it's mm-hmm. going to be okay. And then at some point in time, there's a sort of a panic button pushed and people exodus at once. I think the American embassy has warned people for quite a while.
Yeah.
If you could leave, go ahead and leave.
And Bob, who would these people be? Who would the Americans be who are still in Afghanistan today? Because, you know, it's hard for us to imagine sitting over here and knowing, you know, we were supposed to be pulling out by the end of August, whether or not the fall was going to be rapid or not, you would think, let me get out of here before the very end.
Well, there's several groups. You have the government employees who, you know, the United States government at some point in time says, okay, you're leaving.
Right.
That's pretty simple. But then you have people who are working for the NGOs, non-government organizations, charity mm-hmm. groups, religious groups, you know, you name it, the NGOs are over there. So you have that whole set of Americans and other nationals, British, German, et cetera. Then you have the businesses that were developing in Afghanistan, and they had employees. And then you had contractors who were building, you know, building buildings, that, you know, doing all that type of work. So you have a whole different set of Americans who were working there. And some of them might have had lucrative pay, and they were trying to hold out to see if this would, you know, would collapse or not. And, of course, we know the end result. So that's the wide variety of people that would still have been working over there or were there for the non-government organizations.
Well, Bob, the next time we speak, we'll be on the other side of August 31st. So
yes, we will.
It'll be very interesting what we talk about next week. National correspondent Bob Ney, thank you so much for your insight
thank
on
you.
The news of the world.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. I've been thinking about this for a segment idea for a while. What businesses, and in particular restaurants, took the brave, daring, foolish dive into the risky world of opening a business during the pandemic? It had to be difficult, but there were a number that threw caution to the wind and went for it. Here to tell us about them in the restaurant business is 7 Days food writer Melissa Passanen. Melissa, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint, and thanks for writing this story.
Thank you for having me and for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
So I'm amazed that anyone would have opened a new restaurant or bought into an existing restaurant during the pandemic. You talked to five and found out that there were quite a few more. How many did we have go this route during the pandemic?
So one of the things that was really interesting about the research for this project is, anecdotally, the food team at 7 Days has been kind of amazed throughout the pandemic, mm-hmm. you know, after the initial lockdown period. But even then, we did a story on people who opened, like, right then.
Yeah.
And then there was kind of a lull. But we are continually reporting new restaurants more than we're reporting closures. Now, of course, new restaurateurs are more interested in press coverage than those who are sadly, you know, closing, maybe giving up their dream. So there's a little bit of bias there. But we did find some data through the Vermont Department of Health Food and Lodging Program. For folks who might not be aware, they do what's called an opening inspection of every new restaurant opening that is serving food to the public. And also new owner of an existing restaurant. The number we got also includes a restaurant that might have moved to a new location, and there were some of those. But our research showed that during the pandemic period, so 16 months or so, 325 new restaurant licenses, in the way I just explained, were inspected. And that's down just 13% from the equivalent same season pre-pandemic period. So that has to go back to 2018 to 2019. So really kept pretty, you know, close.
Yeah.
And then there's a graph that shows by month, and you can see that especially in recent months, the numbers are at least very close, if not higher, than prior to the pandemic.
What have been the biggest hurdles for getting these establishments open and operating normally?
So, I mean, they are facing the same hurdles that all restaurants are facing right now. So I'm sure everyone is aware there is a huge employment issue. This is not just hitting restaurants, but restaurants are very heavy on, you know, needing, many of them, on needing employees. And that has been a massive challenge. I interviewed Claudia Amparo, who is a new owner of Parkside Cafe in Hinesburg. She moved her Baba's Tacos food truck operation, all the prep, to that space. Prior to that, she was running her food truck, but almost all food trucks use, like, a commercial kitchen space to do a lot of their prep. So she moved that closer to her home in Hinesburg, where her husband and three young sons live. And she said, like, she came, bought that business and came onto it in November of last year. And there was one woman cooking in the kitchen who stayed on. And then that woman had to leave because she had children at home and she couldn't find childcare, which is a huge issue. So again, that relates to employment, but I think everyone knows childcare slots are very tough. And, you know, a lot of people had their kids home doing, you know, distance learning. So that takes at least one parent, you know, pretty much out of the workforce. What are you going to do? So that is a huge issue. Also, and it's all kind of related, you know, increases in cost of goods. That goes from paper goods, you know, so much takeout containers now that people didn't always use. You know, every restaurant pretty much pivoted to takeout. So all of a sudden, you need, like, way more takeout containers. And cost of goods like flour has gone up 7 times. Cooking oil, you know, things we don't think about, but those are huge issues. And then not to mention, obviously, consumer roller coaster confidence, right? So consumers didn't want to eat, and then they started feeling comfortable eating outside, eating inside. Then there was kind of a boom, but restaurants had no staff, so that was super challenging and still is. Now consumer confidence is a little shaky again because of the Delta variant, so just a ton of stuff. And again, those are not specific to new restaurants. One of the things that is specific, more specific to new restaurants, is if you need to do construction. So I talked to a couple restaurants, like the couple that bought Mary's in Bristol. They relocated from the Bay Area. Interesting story. So this is Kate Barron and Jason Crimsey. They were both in food and hospitality there. We're planning to actually move their family with two young sons to Spain. Like, we're ready to go. Had tickets booked, had, you know, navigated the visa thing. And then all of a sudden they couldn't go because of COVID. So they're like, well, we need to leave California. It's too much of fires, too much congestion, can't afford to buy anything. So they do a road trip and they end up in Vermont, partly because Kate went to UVM, but they have family on the East Coast, and they end up buying Mary's Restaurant, which listeners may be aware was like a, you know, very early locavore destination over 40 years.
Iconic with Chef Doug Mack.
Yeah, Doug Mack and Linda Harmon had built that. And so they end up buying it. There's more detail in the story, but I won't get into it. But they ended up buying it, and then they needed to do construction. Kate said she called 15 to 20 construction companies in Addison and Chittenden County, and no one could fit them in until the end of this year. So they ended up through a network finding a pair of folks from, I think, North Carolina, South Carolina. And those folks, South Carolina, those folks came up for 5 weeks this summer, and Jason said, you know, without them, we'd be dead in the water. When I was there, there was actually a local team, Mountain Builders from Bristol, who had managed to fit them in their schedule. But so, you know, just another area of, you know, the industry that is super understaffed and super busy. So that was kind of, that's more of a new construction issue, new restaurant issue that maybe the others aren't worried about so much.
And that's reopening as the Tillerman.
Thank you. I will be reopening as the Tillerman with a chef, Justin Wright, who also relocated during the pandemic from the Bay Area and actually was the opening chef at Cesar, which was briefly operating out of the Radio Bean space in Burlington. And they have a beautiful, like, wood-fired oven. They're going to do pizza and some really cool things there. Yeah, that's supposed to open in the fall, and it is called the Tillerman. Thanks for that, Rick.
All right, let's head to Stowe, to Big Fish. Great name. Who's behind this?
So this was a really great one to include because Jack Pickett, who has been in the restaurant industry in Stowe since the 70s, I thought he would have really good, like, big historical perspective. Like, he's opened, this is his seventh restaurant, so how does it feel different?
Right.
He said he also had issues finding construction folks. They were redoing the space that previously had been sort of the in hotel restaurant at Commodore's Inn. Right as you come into Stowe, it's on the right. And so they needed to do a pretty big refresh. And he said he ended up having cooks, like, do carpentry. And he himself has a carpentry background, too, so he was able to do some of the work. But he said that was kind of the toughest thing. And I was there when they were actually having kind of a drop-in job fair. And, you know, a number of people stopped by, and he thought they were going to be okay to open, which I thought was interesting. I think he has a very solid reputation in that area. Like, I talked to this one woman who dropped by to inquire about a server position. And she's 33, Jen, and she said that, her last name is Jen Grant. I mean, her full name is Jen Grant. She worked with Jack when she was 16 at the Whip in Stowe, and she
sort of knows his
reputation, and she knew that he, you know, is an uber professional, runs a good ship, and I think that was really helping him staff up, whereas, you know, maybe a new restaurant where someone had no, you know, reputation in town would have a harder time.
I love the idea as cooks as carpenters. If you can use a serrated knife, you can use a saw.
And actually related to staffing, so one of the places I wrote about in Burlington, the Cafe Hot, is a pair of brothers who both relocated from New York City during the pandemic, and one of them has super serious culinary cred. And the other was actually in commercial and music video production. But they are very specifically opening, this is in the former space of Mirabelle's Bakery and Cafe on Main Street in Burlington. They are very specifically opening with breakfast only, something that the two of them can handle by themselves, so they don't need to find staff. You know, they may, you know, ramp up and add other things, but for right now, that's what they're doing to help deal with that staffing issue.
That's pretty wise. All right, we got about a minute left. Can you take us through the sushi place in Burlington
so
in a minute?
That's the final one. So Sushi Maeda, which folks in Burlington will perhaps know, has been coming soon on Cherry Street in the old OGE, Outdoor Gear Exchange space. It ran into some some contractor issues early on, but then they got that ramped up again right before the pandemic, then of course had to hit pause. But this shall be an awesome, huge place with not just sushi by sushi master Kazutoshi Mike Maeda, who has also Bento, Little Bento on College Street.
Yep.
So just beautiful sushi. He has amazing, you know, skills. Used to be in New York City, got reviewed in the New York Times, and that is opening, and it will have only takeout and delivery to start, but they will also have this really cool Japanese-style charcoal grill bar, and they're going to do ramen and dumplings, but the sushi, his sushi is just beautiful, so we're excited about that, definitely.
All right. You can find Melissa's story in this week's edition of 7 Days. Online at 7daysvt.com. Melissa, always wonderful to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we're going to be back after a special CBS News report. Then we'll talk with St. Mike's professor Jeff Ayers about the recent report about the closed Canadian border. And don't forget, today during the getaway, your chance to win the McKenzie Meats Summer Grilling Package. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. The last time I was across our northern border, I had a Dunn's smoked meat sandwich and went to see a senior league hockey team called the Oilmen of the North play in an old arena in the Montreal suburb of Laval. It was outstanding, especially because it was so Canadian and so very Quebecois. But the border closing has had a greater effect in keeping me from salted meat products and some serious on-ice punch-ups. A new report has taken a look at the impacts. It's called the 2021 Border Barometer, and we have one of the people who worked on it with us now. Jeff Ayers is a political science and international relations professor at St. Michael's College, the one here in Vermont. Jeff, it's great to hear you on the program. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
And listeners, if you've got a question for Jeff Ayers about the report, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jeff, who requested this report, and what was it they wanted to know?
I think it was less of a request than the Border Policy Research Institute, which is based out at Western Washington University, had previously published a border barometer in a more benign way, just looking at relations in different areas, different regional areas between the two countries. And the thought was, in the midst of the pandemic, it might be useful to have data on the impact of the border closure. So the Western Washington University Border Policy Research Institute sort of collaborated, communicated with the government of Canada, and the government of Canada agreed, found it useful to have this study run, and ultimately the Canadian government funded it with eight different researchers, including myself, across, again, between the two countries, publishing regional reports.
So the full border is what they were looking at, and you
right.
got to handle the region here. Who were the people who collaborated on the research for the report?
Well, they're colleagues in different parts. There were two Canadians and six Americans, and we were based in the regions were Alaska, Cascadia, the Great Plains and the Mountain West, the Upper Midwest, Detroit-Windsor area, Buffalo-Niagara. I had the Vermont-Quebec region, and then there was Maine-Quebec and New Brunswick. So they're all primarily academic-based researchers, again, majority American, a couple of Canadians who've sort of a long-time interest in Canadian-U.S. relations who had including myself, who had been doing research on the border for some time.
Now, we know that here in Vermont, Quebec, our number one trade partner, but how important is the U.S. to the Canadian economy overall and vice versa?
Oh, we're huge. We're historically been essential to each other. It's an asymmetrical relationship. Obviously, Canada I don't know the exact number. I'm going to say traditionally it's been 70% of Canada's exports, if not more. It varies a tiny bit, go to the United States. Ours is less than that, but we're still certainly dependent on the Canadian market. But it's Canadians who are particularly dependent on the U.S. market, and it's only expanded since the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement came into being in 1989. So there's been a significant liberalization of trade and investment through the Free Trade Agreement, through NAFTA, now the USMCA. So the two countries are incredibly interdependent economically, and which speaks to what happened with the border closure. I mean, when the border was closed by mutual agreement on March 21st, 2020, it was closed to all non-essential travel. I mean, I think what both countries, but especially Canadians, wanted to avoid was what happened after 9/11 immediately, which was a complete border shutdown, and there was a recognition that that would be incredibly economically disruptive. So I think both countries, policymakers, business people, recognize how important it is to try to keep essential traffic, commercial traffic, healthcare and such moving between the two countries.
So what did the report find regarding the decline in traffic between the two countries, and what did you find specifically in your region?
You know, I mean, just broadly, the report found, and it wasn't surprising on the one hand, the report found that there was a collapse in cross-border passenger traffic. It didn't matter what region you looked at. In our region, for example, in the Quebec-Vermont region, including Plattsburgh, New York, the passenger traffic through the beginning of this year was down, averaged 97% lower. I mean, it was in 2019, over 5 million people crossed the border between the five ports of entry, the Quebec-Vermont ports of entry, and that just, you know, cratered. I think the key, again, one of the key indicators is the way in which, for a very brief period of time initially into April 2020, truck traffic dipped a bit, but it more or less steadied. So again, commercial traffic continued. The purpose of the project was pretty interesting because it wasn't just to gather together that sort of hard data on the impact of the border closure, but I would say a really important reason for the study was to highlight both the connections, the ties, the cross-border ties that exist between peoples on both sides of the border across the different regions, and also to highlight the kind of, you know, colorful stories, the people stories, the impact on, for instance, the impact on the, you know, Church Street Marketplace in Burlington and so forth. So that was the people impact was something that all of us wanted to highlight.
Well, we like to think that there's not even a border. There's not even a line between our friends in Quebec and Vermont. It seems like we've had this wonderful relationship back and forth going back centuries. So what did you find in the personal stories when you dug into it?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say broadly first, the personal stories were that we – you're right. I like to think that way as well, that it's gotten much more formal, needing a passport and such, we still perhaps took for granted how easy it would be here in the greater Burlington area to decide in the morning, I want to go up to Montreal for dinner or vice versa. You always see the Je me souviens, you know, license plates in the greater area. So that disappeared. I mean, I noticed it constantly that you never saw Quebec license plates here. You still don't. I mean, obviously that's the great puzzle. We can talk about that in a minute. But you saw just a complete collapse of Canadian visitors to the state, which is huge. I mean, about 85% of all international visitors to Vermont are from Canada. I think Canadians inject over $150 million a year into the state's economy. So that was a huge hit. We had fun with little sort of breakouts, and I focused, for instance, on if you're from Vermont or if you've been here a while, everybody knows about the area up in the middle of the border of the Stansted, Quebec, and the Derby Line, Vermont area, and the famous Haskell Free Library and Opera House that exists on both sides of the border. And how there's the children's section is in one side, and the periodicals are in another, and that obviously literally stopped. I mean, the library had to close; people couldn't return books. They have a performance group up there, the Borderline Players, a binational group, had to postpone performances. The Border Jets, which is a recreational youth hockey team based in Stansted, Quebec, but is roughly 50% Canadian, 50% U.S., had to suspend the season. I mean, those little micro stories on the border you know, we're what people experience all across the Canada-U.S. border that I think gets lost in that data of, you know, 97% decline in passenger traffic.
Now, I guess this question is kind of a veiled question to see if you are considered essential, but were you able to travel into Canada to do your research?
Oh, no, not at all. No, there was no – it was even here in Vermont, it was tough. You know, it was more Zooming and, you know, online. That's a great question because I'm part of a large research team supported by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada. And we've had to shift all of our research in the same way we've been teaching. A lot of our research almost entirely has been by Zoom, is online now. So, no, I haven't been I heard your intro. I haven't been into Montreal since February of 2020 when I flew out of Montreal to go up to Edmonton.
Mm. Oh, it's great when you go out and you fly within Canada because you've already gone through customs at the border. Mm-hmm. I did that to Halifax one year, and it's phenomenal. Personally, what have you missed about going up to Canada?
Oh, God, I've missed for one thing, I've missed what I said, the deciding early in the day, on particularly on a weekend, wanting to go up to Montreal, go to the art museum, or just to be able to walk around in the city, and certainly to have dinner. A good friend of mine has season tickets to the Habs, the Canadiens. Mm-hmm. Didn't go see any of those games last year. I've lived in Ottawa on and off several years, and I love that city. It's one of my favorite cities in the world, and so I've that's a huge loss. I usually travel up there a couple of times. I've missed the class. I've been teaching Canadian politics here at St. Michael's College. This will be my 24th year starting this Monday, and I couldn't take students for the first time ever on our 3-day field trip to Ottawa, which is a wonderful experience. So so there's been a lot that I've missed personally and professionally by not being able to go across the border.
And Vermonters, if you've never been to Ottawa, Jeff is absolutely right, and it is not that far, about 3.5-hour drive from most parts of Vermont. You'll love it. Jeff, are there specific businesses that seem to suffer the most without Canadian visitors, or towns or regions here in our area?
No, certainly the border towns. And I mean, right on the border. I lived in, you know, St. Albans for 9 years, and I don't know the exact data, but I know that for certain, with not being able to have Quebecers come down and, you know, for the summer to stay in their cottages along Lake Champlain and Swanton and such, that certainly had an impact. I did a specific little piece on the ski industry. I mean, that's half of Vermont's total tourism industry is tied to the ski industry. Over 4 million skiers visit annually, and That had a big impact with ski resorts. All of them have Canadians visit, but certainly the ones that are closer to the border, including Jay Peak, only a few miles south of the border, usually saw half of its skiers visit from Quebec. So its pass sales, for example, its season's pass sales were down roughly 30% from 2019. So I think that's a good example. But just in, you know, the anecdotal part of certainly on a weekend when I'm strolling around the Church Street Marketplace and seeing when I'm parking all the different Quebec license plates and the, you know, the Bienvenue Québécois stickers that we have on a lot of the stores in the greater Burlington area welcoming Quebecers, that obviously had a huge impact, not having Quebecers down here buying and staying and purchasing goods.
We mentioned our love, the mutual love. So will this trial separation have any effect on our marriage with our loves to the north?
I don't think it'll have a personal impact, except that I don't think it'll change people who've already loved Quebec and vice versa. And believe me, Quebecers love Vermont in general. I don't think it'll impact that love as much. I do think what we're going to see is fewer people crossing for a while. I mean, after 9/11, after the September 11 terrorist attacks, there was a dramatic decline in cross-border traffic that never actually fully recovered. And I think I think it'll take some time, you know, before we reach, you know, pre-pandemic levels. And again, we're not there yet. I can't tell you. I'm puzzled as to why we haven't opened the border to vaccinated Canadians.
Right.
And I know that Canadians are puzzled by that as well.
And they have surpassed us in vaccination
rates.
So indeed, we should be reopening it. All right. I mentioned politics. Canadians are in the middle of their long drawn out federal election. Jeff, how long does that thing last?
Yeah, I laughed because it doesn't last long at all, right? I mean, this, they last rarely longer than 5 to 6 weeks. This one happens to be the shortest allowed under Canadian election law. It's a 36-day campaign that concludes on September 20th. So imagine, just compare that to our midterm elections, which will be coming up, and then suddenly we'll be thinking about the presidency again. Mm-hmm. It's so short in Canada.
I was watching a Canadian Football League game, and all of a sudden there was an ad for the Conservatives, and that's when I realized, oh my gosh, they're in. They've started the election. Now, despite the party leader being the face of the party and becomes the prime minister if they hold their seat, Canadians don't get to choose between Justin Trudeau and the others. So explain how that works.
Yeah, that's right. The Canadians, you need 170 seats to get a majority. And every candidate, every MP comes from what's called a riding. It's similar to a congressional district. But you only, Justin Trudeau, who's currently the prime minister, comes from Papineau, a riding in the greater Montreal area. So only a few 100,000 people or so are actually voting. They see Justin Trudeau's name on the ballot, as opposed to Americans, no matter where you are, you saw, you know, Joe Biden or Donald Trump's name. So you're voting for an MP, and then whatever MP is the leader of the political party, and that party gets a plurality of the vote or a majority of the vote, that person becomes the prime minister. So it is a very different system in that Canadians don't vote directly for the person who becomes prime minister.
And MP is member of parliament. So when it's Canadian election time, when it's Quebec election time, it's the only time I stay up late and tweet. And I did not stay up late and tweet that long ago. The last election was a federal election there just a couple years ago.
That's right. So that's what makes this is a little unusual. Also something that we're not accustomed to. One can't do is that it's called a snap election. So Trudeau went to the governor general a little over 2 weeks ago and requested that she dissolve, Parliament, the House of Commons, and she agreed, as they always do, and they, or at least they almost always do, and an election was called. And I think it's a risk. So you're right. He had two more years, conceivably. Not necessarily. It was a minority government, something else that's unusual. So Trudeau came in 2015 with a majority government. In 2019, in the federal election, lost that majority, and the Liberals had a minority. They had to depend on, normally it was the NDP that they would depend on for legislation. And I think it's a risk that he's taken, that the prime minister has taken, asking to have an election called, because if you look at the polls right now, it's a dead heat.
Mm. And I think in the last election, when you look overall, the raw numbers, the Conservative Party actually did outpoll the Liberals by a slight margin. So Trudeau's Liberals did have some scandals. Are they forgotten now with the handling of the pandemic, or are they still fresh in the voters' minds?
Yes, good question. I think the scandals are largely forgotten, or at least are not a big part of this campaign. I think the two big issues of the campaign are one, that Trudeau, I think, does feel that this was the time to call an election. He's trying to frame the election as a referendum on his leadership, on the Liberal Party's governing, which overall has Canadians see the Liberals and the Liberal government as having done fairly well. During the pandemic, there was a little bit of a delay in getting Canadians vaccinated, but now they have a higher vaccination rate than Americans. Obviously, per capita, far fewer deaths than in the United States. So that's his gamble is, can I frame this election call, this snap election, as a referendum on our leadership and the party most able to lead the country through the months and years after COVID? But what's the problem is, and this has been written quite a bit about the last couple of weeks, the more Canadians think about whether the election needed to be called in the first place is going to work potentially against him. And that seems to be what's happening. A lot of Canadians are asking, was this really necessary? We're in the midst of this Delta variant surge. And I think that in part, that's one of the reasons you're seeing a tightening of the polls, because at best, I think Trudeau's Liberals will get a minority. I don't think the majority government that his party thought they could get only a few weeks ago is within reach anymore.
I'm going to give you 45 seconds to answer the last question. The Bloc Québécois, where do they fit into the national picture?
Yeah, great. Interesting question, because they did very well in the last election in 2019. They regained official party status. Blanchet is a pretty charismatic leader of the Bloc Québécois, the federal separatist party. But there's been quite a bit discussed about this lately. There's sort of a truce right now between Legault, the premier of Quebec, mm-hmm. and Trudeau, the prime minister of Canada, two Quebecers. So that the normal, I guess, say, the traditional ability for a Quebec separatist politician to find problems with the federal government and its relationship with Quebec isn't there right now. So I don't think the Bloc's may do quite as well. They're very low in single digits in polling. Obviously, they only get seats from Quebec, but I don't think they're much of an impact right now.
Jeff Ayres is a professor of political science and international relations at St. Michael's College. To learn more about the 2021 Border Barometer, go to cedar.wwu.edu. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us this morning. We look forward to having you back after the Canadian election on September 20th.
I really enjoyed it, and I look forward to coming back, Rick.
All right, great. That's our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.